Colonel Verini, Reel 15. We were talking on the last tape, Colonel, of Camp Casey. You'd been to Japan, you returned to Camp Casey. Have you any other memories of Camp Casey before we move on?
No, additional memories. It was just that I didn't enjoy it very much when I was there. I was glad to go back into the line. No additional.
So what day did you move back from Camp Casey?
We leave the second United States Infantry Division on the 6th of April. And we went on to the rather large feature called Gibraltar by the Americans, officially known as Koang San, 1.359 meters. It's quite a hard trip. And we found the place even worse than the 210 that we finally took over from the Royal Fusiliers. The communication trenches were collapsing, and there were jagged pieces of metal and stuff sticking out from where we just showed. The slit trenches were patterned and non-existent. The Americans were cowering in their trenches, or what shelter they had. Every American seemed to be armed with a heavy machine gun, as far as I could make out. There were so many automatic weapons on the site, but I couldn't understand why they should be so scared. And they were also being ambushed in their own minefield gaps as they were going along. So, and all in all, it was a big relief, I should think, for these 10 US divisions to get out of the place. And it was a little traumatic for us because we had to start immediately sorting the place out and making it habitable for a start. And also, can't be known to dominate the no man's land by the active terror. So we started that almost immediately. I remember fairly soon after we got back to the fighting patrol. And the Americans were in the habit of taking out a telephone whenever they went out on patrol, which meant that they had to run out combat cable, which was thin black stuff, which just would run out through the minefield gaps whenever they went out. So the result was that the minefield gaps were fairly thick with the mass of this cable. It did prove that they had been going out, of course, if nothing else, but anyway, it was a matter of the same. And I remember my batman and I called Tubby Hall from Seaham Harbour. He was absolutely festooned with stuff. He had his armoured vest on. He had six spare Sterling magazines on his chest. He had the two parts of the radio. And he was only about 4'11". That typical miner spare out of the mine, out of the pits. And he got his foot caught in one of the piece of string. He literally took off the ground and landed flat on his stomach and let out a woof. And then there was a deathly hush for a bit because, you know, it was a dark night. We were having to keep quiet. And silence, because everybody was a bit shocked by the noises of the woof coming up. And then he recovered enough to be able to start swearing about the Americans. And he called them every name under the sun, told his voice. And I was saying, kicking him and saying, shut up and go anyway, calm down, eventually. And then just literally, another 10 yards or so further on, we came to the minefield. And right across the track that we were following was a piece of wire with the wear mines on it. And I thought, my goodness, what do we do here? What does that mean? You know, after some consideration, I eventually got to walk, stepped over the wire, went down, I saw the other way, and went down to the far end of the wire where there was another thing, big wear mine. And I assumed that it was a mistake and it was just a continuation of the line for the wire, which was wired off the over the mine. But the track was not mine because I wasn't doing enough anyway. So I went back and got the others and we went home. And that was a ridge. We were actually, on that occasion, we were right at the top of the hill. The hill was the highest in the area. It was overlooking everything. And it was magnificent strategic point, which was very important in the line generally. It was probably one of the highest hills in the whole of the front line. And it was a great honour, really, that we would have been given it to take to look after. It had originally been taken by the Argyles, I think it was, and when the Australians had to do a counterattack and finally consolidated on it. And we regarded ourselves as custodians of what the Australians had done. And it was the highest point in the long ridge, which stretched over towards Panmunjom, so presumably somewhere like the northeast. When we occupied the highest point, and then just down below the 0.227, the first of the remaining series of hilltops was the Chinese, who were probably from our front line, probably only about 50 yards or so away from the forward. And we stretching off to either side, in our case it was west, with various ridges going down into the valley, which was itself overlooked by a fairly high Chinese position on the opposite side of the valley. Very steep, and it was essential really to dominate that valley in order to keep them away from. It wasn't the most important point of the defensive position. That was largely the company that was facing the Chinese on 227, because it was a fairly easy run in from them, from there up to the top. Very narrow ridge, actually, it was. I have quite a number of photographs of it.
Was it again? Was it a bare ridge? Right, yeah.
It was almost like striding edge at Hale Valley. It was not quite as narrow as that, but that type of ridge with spurs going off mainly for westwards. There were odd spurs going down into our valley, which was between us and 0.210. Remember, I was telling you that 0.210 was overlooked by 355 and 227.
And these numbers represent the heights of the
building. Yes, yeah. They were all heights. Our first one, Major, was 1.3, and then 2.2, and then 355. And in between ourselves and 210, there was a road. Came known as Tin Can Alley, I think it was. And it was a bit dicey there. You had to be careful, even at night. You had to be aware of the fact that it was being shelled or could be shelled. Anyway. So it was a vital point, and it was absolutely necessary that we should keep the Chinese away from it. Which meant that we had to do the aggressive bit to get them out of the way.
The positions you said were pretty poor. So what was the first thing that you did as a battalion to improve them?
As a battalion, we had to sort them out. We had to invent them, which we did. We used to make our own sticks. These are sticks interwoven like baskets, and put them against the wall. We used those because if they were shelled, they didn't have any jagged. The Americans were using corrugated iron, which when it was shelled, the jagged holes would be blown, and the jagged pieces would be sticking out. So we changed to hurdles, so the sort of osier hurdles. I don't know where they got the fine sticks from, but because they got them, we managed to do most of the communication trenches anyway. And then as we did on 210, we dug our slip trenches a lot deeper, and our headquarters code of Uchis, and that's what they sorted them out, brought in the prefab Uchis. And what the Australians called trench beautification. We used a special tool, which was like a platter. And we remember those little platters that we used to use to make the buckle into a shape, rather like that. And we'd half fill the sandbag, pack, get it down, turn the loose pushed it over and then plonked it into position, rather like the bricks of a house, so that the gaps were overlapping. And then you would pat it into shape, which would give a sort of brick-like appearance. We never had any problems from the air, so we didn't bother to camouflage overhead. All that was necessary was just to get pieces of trim and lift it above the level of the trench that you were digging, and that would be sufficient to cover this or spoil and stuff that you were in front of it. We did a lot of that by day, actually. I photographed a team of about four or five people to use rubbish, building a trench that was broad daylight. You had to be careful because every now and again they'd say, it's a bit of a cheek, and they'd send over the mortar bucket, mortar bomb. No, mortars aren't terribly accurate, so you can get away with it.
Were the Chinese also only active at night? So in effect, that this was the most active time.
Most activity on both sides was in the dark. So really, having thought about the position and made it habitable and safer, the concentration was on capture a prisoner. We did actually shortly after moving in take one wounded prisoner. What the circumstances of that was, I think it was a lad called David Margaret. There'd been a clash a couple of nights before, and I found this chap wounded and brought him in. He wasn't any good because he almost wounded himself to death when he was brought in. And we didn't get any information from him at all. This was the occasion as well when the Americans said they would have an air raid on 227. And the idea was that they would blast the thing out of creation, and then we would send in a group of full-body soldiers to take the place over and occupy it. And I remember Sergeant Chadwick, who already had a man around, was put in charge of the other, why it was in there, why it wasn't an officer, but anyway, he was the commander of the small group, was living about, I think it was about 32. Prior to the Americans came up and did a wreck, and the cap, in those terms, the baseball cap was rather like these hats that we wear for golf these days. He had a bright yellow and blue cap. He came up and immediately caused chaos because the Chinese started to shudder because he was wandering around with his hat on. Anyway, we managed to calm him down and get him into some sort of hiding, and he did the recce. And then he went on the day of the event, he came up again. He was the controller of the airport. They were the Marine Air Force, presumably the cream of the, American Air Force. We could expect the place to be blasted out of existence altogether. I think there was something like 30 aircraft involved, each with two bombs on the a bomb on each wing, dropping on the hill, and very, very few actually hit the position. It was a two-hour raid, and I think probably about six or so bombs actually hit the top. Some of them bounced off. A couple of them landed on the 210, which was that they bounced or missed altogether. It meant that they were coming in the wrong way. They were coming in from the enemy side. Whereas if they'd come in from our side, we would have passed on to there. Anyway, Chadwick, I remember, came wandering up with his police group looking very forlorn and wondering what it was all about. It was after 2 hours, it was decided that not enough damage had been done to the opposition to warrant the lives of the, or endangering the lives of the Soviet members, and those he was caught up. It wasn't a very impressive display of air power by the Americans. One hears about friendly fire and all that, and the understand it. They don't think you've got to drop a bomb to get over the way, even the Marines. That's what it feels like.
And there's no casualties to your own men?
Oh, no. Not that I can recall, anyway. The Chinese did react a bit by sending over a few shells, but they were largely aimed at this chap that was doing the English hat, but all lived in the vicinity of where it was.
Well, while we're on about the Americans, when you moved into the position, were you taking over from a unit about the same size as your own? Or
yes,
or
the
tendencies?
I think American battalions, actually, are the equivalent of our brigades, aren't they? I'm not at all sure. One peculiarity, actually, about this particular event, which probably showed the importance of it, was the difference between our form of defence and the American form of defence was that we occupied in strength and the Americans occupied as an outpost. So they had two lines of defence. One was an outpost line of resistance, which was OPLR, and that would probably be something like, so I may have mentioned this before, may be about 1,000 yards ahead of what we call the MLR, the main line of resistance. And the idea was, rather like our static controls, the people in front gave warning of what was happening, and then having put on a token, put a token resistance on, they then withdrew to the mainland resistance. And the theory there, one would hope, was that they would then stay in fight. But very often, the mainland resistance then became the outpost line of resistance, and would get moving back, which meant, really, as in the case of the Gloucesters and Northumberland Fusiliers earlier, that we would tend to be left out on a limb with our two companies, two or three companies up. But on this particular occasion, the whole battalion was, American unit, was on the hill. There was no outpost line of resistance at all, which made things a lot easier for us, because it meant that we were then occupying a position already prepared as a whole battalion up. Now, therefore, the most important thing after the rejuvenation of the position was to keep Chinese on the go. So patrolling became paramount, both actively offensive and defensive. And there were all sorts of methods used. One of them, which Peter de la Villiers didn't think very much of, which I thought was very good, was three large patrols, fighting patrols, being controlled by a small control unit of a senior officer and a wireless operator, going out and occupying positions, and more or less positions of ambush, really. And I think I did one of the first ones, anyway, who went out. The night we went out the first time, where it was a heavy mist fog came down, and couldn't see more than about 5 or 6 yards. So I said to Moody, we'll go out, I was still light, and got the mist, and we'll find a good position in daylight. They were taking the others to do all the light, so they want to come out when they can. We go now. So we set off and went down the hill, and about 100 yards down the hill, it was clear. You could see the ceiling of mist, but couldn't see very far. Probably had a visibility of about 3/4 of a mile or something like that, and once you got out of the mist. that was a bit of a shock, but almost immediately after we got out of the mist, I saw, bearing in mind that both of us removed a perverted eardrum, and I was suffering from noise from what. Both of us thought we heard somebody shout, "Hello, Johnny." We must have been something. He also sort of turned around to see it come from behind us, and we couldn't see anything that remotely resembled any sort of hiding place at all. So we thought, well, it must have been a ball of delusion. Anyway, we got a good spot and sat down there. We had to sit there all until just before first light and come in. And that particular night, we were between the two ridges down in the fourth gully, between two ridges, and the other two of the one patrol was on the right hand ridge, which was the one where we'd had problems with the minefield. There was another group on the left hand ridge, and then further down in front of the left hand ridge was the third group, and we just sat there all night. And one occasion, the people on the right hand side said they thought that they heard movement in front of them, could they have some form of fire? So I said, well, how far ahead do you think they are? Or about 20 to 25 yards in front of us. So I said, well, do you want shell fire? He said, yes, that's pretty close. The order's all right there, so I rang back and explained the situation. And we had the New Zealand gunners supporting us, and they put down 5 rounds straight away, actually. And the accuracy was incredible. None of our people heard at all. And we could hear this stuff flying all over the place as well. I don't know what actually happened with the noise, but the patrol didn't want them. They had the fire around, and that was it. They seemed to be happy. And that was really the end of the thing as far as excitement during the night was concerned. The main problem was staying away.
And you were controlling these three fighting units by radio.
They had to do whatever they had to do, and if I wasn't, it was something I would tell them to do.
So you were in radio contact with the battalion and with the three? Were you junior officers leading the three patrols?
Yes. In this particular case, yes. It wasn't always the case. But in this particular case, there were three young men.
Did the Chinese retaliate for odd shell fire like this? Did they set up any fire?
No, didn't have any retaliation. Well, it was a very quiet night. The biggest danger was the clash between two patrols. I remember, coming back, and I said, "Right, as they got back, they put down heavy machine gun fire to cover the movement, noise the movement, and that sort of thing." Making contact with one of the returning patrols to go back in with them, it was a slightly nerve-wracking time. They could see them coming. You weren't absolutely certain whether they had opened up or not, because they were wearing balaclava helmets and camouflage and that sort of thing. However, it went off all right when they came in.
And you essentially, you dominated no man's land.
Yes, yes, yes.
And you did this, you were able to do this. You made
various ways. That was just one way.
Yes.
I mentioned that because, Eddie Dillon really, I didn't think it was a good idea, but also, Johnny Tassona was killed on one of those trails. What he was doing then, I don't know. It wasn't really necessary for a couple of commanders to quote. Anyway, he'd gone us, and at the end of the night, he said to his patrol, was like, off you go, back. And they had put down heavy machine gun fire to cover them. And what I heard, the report was that he got up to go up with his back with his wireless operator, and about 10 or 15 yards in front of him, about 15 or so Chinese also got up. And he said to his back again, why did it? And he said to me, thinking we gave him a grenade, he said, throw that at them. the signal did come back. And they opened fire, and they killed Johnny. I think they wounded the signal, but we got the body out, the two of them back.
Which company did he command?
It was D Company, I think, which was in reserve.
Was it very important to bring bodies in, even if you had to risk your people to go out and get them to bring them in?
Oh yes. I think that was important.
Why did de Billier not like that method of?
He didn't think it was tactically sound.
Because he was only a second lieutenant at that time.
Right, dad at the time. He'd been stuck in Cuba because he was too young. And Peter Jeffrey said that as soon as he was 18, I think, or 19, he could come over. And he had just been stayed in Cuba until he was 18 and he came over. And that was, of course, of the story is that when he arrived, Peter said, "Welcome, and what's your Christian name?" And he said, Peter said, "Oh, there's too many Peters in the battalion, so you've got another name." He said, "Edward." Get right before Eddie. He was called Eddie de la Villiers. And the soldiers couldn't pronounce de la Villiers, so they called him Eddie Smith. And he'd been known with that in the regiment as Eddie Smith ever since. The fact that he was in later on in the special forces, you know, it was very secret, it proved to be a very useful alias. Anyway. We also had another, I was on duty in the CP one night. Jim was having a night off, and we sent out a recce patrol, a man called Ratcliffe. Had gone out, and he'd gone down the ridge, what I can call the minefield ridge, and the firm base was going to be situated at the bottom of the ridge, and he would then go on and do his recce. And they'd been out about 3/4 of an hour or so, and we heard a burst of burp gun fire, two bursts. It's called burp gun because the firing sequence was so rapid it sounded like a bar. And we heard two of these. And I had the radio and I said, "Are they all right?" No answer. So I said, "If you're okay, would you press the switch twice?" And that did actually happen. And that was the last communication that we had with Raymond, I think it was. He had an Australian wireless operator, and that literally was the last we ever heard or saw of them. The firm base was ordered to come back in. Anyway, they came in, and Jim Irvings rang the CO to say, would you like another fighter patrol to go out and see what happened? And he was told not to do that. And we then went out the next night, and we went down. And all we came back with was a burp gun from that area.
No bodies or?
No bodies, nothing.
And they've never ever been found to this day?
They've been missing. They're posted on the war memorial in Busan, in the Commonwealth Cemetery, as posted. Missing in action, yeah. Never heard of them.
And how many was there? There was this chap Ratcliffe, and how many had he with him?
He was accompanied by his wireless operator, who was an Australian.
And just the two of them?
No, it was just the two of them, yes. Mm-hmm. But there was the firm base was there. It was an unpleasant evening. What was the next thing? Well, I don't know if that was this time. Anyway, in May, I can't remember the exact date, the Australians took over from us on the 255, and we went into reserve again until the beginning of June.
So much banter as you switched over when, you know, Australians coming in, you were going out?
Yes, Pond and they couldn't have cared less about anything. I don't think I saw them before they came and made an error. Oh, no, he was pumping all over the place. We were actually glad to get out of the way because all the mayhem that was going on. And they were going around admiring all this French unification.
did they respect you as a unit?
Oh yes. We used to get in this particular case, we got a sort of advanced part of the team, and they're great friends. They always thought very highly of the